In our sermons on the themes of the teaching of Proverbs, its presentation to us of wisdom, which we said was skillful living in God's world, a life that is capable of bringing out of our living the blessings which the Lord has in store for those who honor Him in the world. We have so far considered the sexual life, marriage, money, and speech. Nobody will have any difficulty realizing that those are key dimensions of human life and have to be managed wisely and well, or even by itself. Any one of those dimensions of human life can sour and cause untold sadness, loss, and pain. Well, so with our subject this evening, the importance of working hard, of being industrious on the one hand, and the sin and the unwisdom of laziness, of indolence on the other. Some of Proverbs' most memorable teaching is devoted to this subject. Go to the ant, O sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise. Without having any chief, officer, or ruler, she prepares her bread in summer and gathers her food in harvest. How long will you lie there, O sluggard? When will you arise from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come upon you like a robber, and want like an armed man. That's 6 through 11. There's something, of course, very typical about this teaching. You can find it in Aesop's fables. You can find it in the aphorisms of Benjamin Franklin. And you can find it in the teaching of responsible parents all over the world. There's nothing distinctly Christian about it, though, of course, as we made a point of emphasizing when we were introducing the book of Proverbs, the larger context of the teaching of the book, its motivation, its spirit, its aim or goal, all is distinctively Christian. Or perhaps we should say, when non-Christians commend the importance of industry and hard work to their children, they are in fact borrowing Christian capital, little as they may realize it. By that I mean there is a sense in which all of us ought to relish the fact that the teaching of the Bible regarding human life is repeated so frequently in the teaching of other religions and philosophies of man. What you have in the Bible, as well as an account of the history of redemption and a summons to faith and holiness of life, is an explanation of the world and of the existence and experience of human beings. The Bible is a book of truth about the way things are and always will be while this world endures. It's precisely this measure of confidence that people can have about the nature of human life that enables reasonably wise people to be able to predict the future to a certain degree. There were plenty of people, as you know, who knew and who said that an economy based on inflated home values and unsecured or inadequately secured debt was bound to be punished for it sooner or later. To base a country's economic life on the assumption that house prices always rise and never fall was foolish. And sooner or later, sooner rather than later, would be proved to be so. Why is that? Because that's how the world works, how God made it to work. Lies, sooner or later, pay a wage. At least they do in a world created by the God of truth. Those strange old scriptures present life as having been ordered in a certain way, with certain laws as inextricably built into it as the law of gravity is built into the physical universe. That is, again and again in the Bible, we find teaching that is not really a description of how life ought to be, but of how life is, always has been, always will be. This is one of the things, without you necessarily thinking about it, this is one of the things that makes the Bible such a wonderfully satisfying book. You read it and you understand the world, everyone's world, your own and that of every other human being. The Bible is an open window on reality. What you find in so much of human life is, in fact, a protest against reality. People want the world to behave differently than it does. There is much of this in the physical sciences. There is much in politics. There is a huge amount of this in the social sciences. The problem is very often conceived in modern life in terms of conforming reality to the wishes of men. That's why there is so much futility in human endeavors to make the world better. Wisdom requires that we conform our desires to reality, not the other way around. Wisdom requires us to accept the limitations imposed upon us by reality, by our own creatureliness, by human sinfulness, and then live accordingly. So much of modern social and political thought is utopian to one degree or another. A better world lies just around the corner for us to create with this initiative or this program or this social change. The fact that we never seem to be able to turn that corner hardly makes a difference. The world that works in a certain way according to certain principles is the world in which we live. We're creatures. We're only that. We're sinful creatures. We've been placed in a world by God who has made his world to function according to certain fixed laws and principles, the reach of which we cannot escape. All human beings share this world, and so there is a reality common to us all and a measure of wisdom that can be common to us all as well. Listen to this from Karl Barth. I don't ordinarily quote Barth in my sermons, but this is particularly well said. What is the obviously outstanding feature of world history? How would you answer that question? What is the obviously outstanding feature of world history? It is the all-conquering monotony. The monotony of the pride in which man has obviously always lived to his own detriment and that of his neighbor. From hoary antiquity and through the ebb and flow of his later progress and recession, both as a whole and in detail, the pride in which he still lives and will most certainly continue to live till the end of time. History constantly reenacts the little scene in the Garden of Eden. And, of course, part of that scene was the desire on the part of Adam and Eve to have something for nothing, rather than to undertake the effort that God had summoned them to invest in obedience and service. Ever since, men have been looking for that piece of fruit, the shortcut, that which would make the hard work of consecrated life somehow unnecessary. But find it, he has not. Millions of people, every single day in the United States of America, are throwing their money away in lotteries. They have an infinitesimally small chance of hitting the jackpot. But they throw their hard-earned money away just because maybe, perhaps, they might be one of the 10 millions who hit that jackpot. So if Proverbs' teaching about hard work proves to be teaching that is widely understood by lots of people around the world, teaching that can be found in the moral instruction of other religions and philosophies of life, that's only as it should be and as we should expect it to be. In Proverbs and in life, poverty is caused by one of three things, though in Proverbs the emphasis falls on the last two. Poverty may be caused by catastrophe, drought, war, earthquake. It may be caused by tyranny or oppression, the evil of other men. Or it may be caused by idleness. Poverty is never in the Bible caused by a lack of resources available in the world as one nowadays so often hears. The cause of poverty is never that the earth God has given us is not good enough and does not supply us with sufficient resources for prosperity. The fact is, the Bible teaches us to believe that God has given men a surplus if only they will lay claim to it. Prosperity, have you thought about this? Prosperity can be achieved working only 6 days out of seven. A few months of work in tilling and sowing can produce a harvest adequate to feed us all for the entire year. There will be enough even to care for widows and orphans when all our needs are supplied. We are never poor because God has inadequately provided for us. Even today, there is no place on earth where human ingenuity and industry cannot render a people prosperous if only corrupt government or human foolishness and greed have not intervened to destroy potential or are not intervening to prevent at least many people from sharing in the harvest of blessing from which God has provided them. Think about some of the most bereft places on earth today. Yemen, Somalia. Those places were once very prosperous countries. What is more, in the case of Proverbs teaching about work and industry, we're talking both about obedience to the law of God and about what we ordinarily find in Proverbs, which we would nowadays call character. Unlike much of what Proverbs teaches us about the sexual life or the right attitude toward money, finer points of Christian living than are covered in the commandments of the law, here we actually have a commandment that expressly addresses the subject. Not only is a life of industry, of hard work, implied in the eighth commandment against theft and the tenth commandment against covetousness, but the fourth commandment is devoted to the obligation of men to be workers. We may sometimes forget this, that the fourth commandment requiring the keeping of the Sabbath day expressly requires us to work the other 6 days of the week. This rhythm of work and rest is found everywhere in the Bible. The Bible is not opposed to rest, it's not opposed to play, but it requires them to be given a place after work. We were put here in this world, Adam was put here before there was sin in this world, to work, to be a steward of the world, to bring from it by work all of the great blessing that God has placed within it. It is because we must work and work hard that the day of rest becomes so important. The Bible doesn't say work 5 days, but six. And in a culture that expects 2 days off from work, Christians should be careful not to treat Saturday as if it were another day of rest and not, in fact, a day for other work, other kinds of work to be done. Fathers, your children, your sons especially, need to see you as a working, hard-working man. So to work is to obey the law of God. And as with all obedience, it ought not to be feigned or half-hearted, but willing and unqualified. something we do enthusiastically, eagerly. We ought to be hard workers 6 days of the week and take our day of rest as seriously as our days of work. Attitudinally, however, then, we are also to be workers. It's to be our way of life to work hard. So a disposition towards industry, a discomfort with the idea that we are not using our time fruitfully, that we're being lazy or self-indulgent, is more than just obedience. It is part of a godly character, an attitude, a viewpoint on life that ought to be characteristic of God's people. And that's true not only in Proverbs, but in the rest of the Bible as well. Remember, it was the Apostle Paul who put the point most bluntly of all. If anyone is not willing to work, let him not eat. For we hear that some among you walk in idleness, not busy at work. There is, therefore, nothing in the Christian faith that can ever be thought to undermine the importance of a life of hard work, of industry and perseverance in responsibility. In any case, the wisdom of industry and the unwisdom of idleness are sufficiently important to Proverbs' conception of wisdom and the skillful life to be repeated over and over and over again throughout the book. Whoever works his land will have plenty of bread, but he who follows worthless pursuits lacks sense. 12:11. The hand of the diligent will rule, while the slothful will be put to forced labor. 12:24. Whoever is slothful will not roast his game, but the diligent man will get precious wealth. 12:27. The soul of the sluggard craves and gets nothing, while the soul of the diligent is richly supplied. 13:4. The way of a sluggard is like a hedge of thorns. 15:19. Whoever is slack in his work is a brother to him who destroys. 18:9. Slothfulness casts into a deep sleep, and an idle person will suffer hunger. 19:15. The sluggard buries his hand in the dish and will not even bring it back to his mouth. 19:24. The sluggard does not plow in the autumn. He will seek at harvest and have nothing. That's 20, verse 4. Love not sleep, lest you come to poverty. Open your eyes and you will have plenty of bread. 20:13. The sluggard says, there's a lion outside. I'll be killed in the streets. 22:13. Do you see a man skillful in his work? He will stand before kings. He will not stand before obscure men. 22:29. Prepare your work outside. Get everything ready for yourself in the field. And after that, build your house. 24:27. I passed by the field of a sluggard, by the vineyard of a man lacking sense. And behold, it was all overgrown with thorns. The ground was covered with nettles, and its stone wall was broken down. Then I saw and considered it. I looked and received instruction. A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come upon you like a robber, and want like an armed man. That's 24:30-34, but very similar, is it not, to the passage I read at the beginning from chapter 6, verses 6 through 11. The sluggard says, there is a lion in the road, there's a lion in the streets. As a door turns on its hinges, so does a sluggard on his bed. The sluggard buries his hand in the dish. It wears him out to bring it back to his mouth. The sluggard is wiser in his own eyes than seven men who can answer sensibly. That's 26:13-16, but it's very like 22:13. And of the virtuous woman, in Proverbs 13 we read, she rises while it is yet night and provides food for her household. 31:15. She looks well to the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Verse 27. Taking all of this material together, we may note some characteristic themes or emphases. The idle or the sluggard, the lazy man or woman, always seeks What is the easier path? The path of least resistance. That's why bed and sleep figure so largely in these proverbs. It's always easier just to stay in bed. It's cold outside, you're comfortable under the covers. There is the implicit recognition in all of this that hard work requires an effort to control the will. It requires initiative, discipline, sacrifice. It's easier to be lazy, a fact that should never be ignored. The discipline of hard work needs to be instilled in children and then consciously practiced in life, precisely because it's contrary to our tendency to prefer the easy way. Remember the steps that Charles Simeon took to discipline himself to get out of bed early in the morning, just what he is told to do in Proverbs. First, he vowed to give half a crown to his cleaning lady whenever he was late getting out of bed, but then he found himself staying in bed and excusing it because the woman needed the money, he figured, and then vowing to throw a gold crown in the River Cam in Cambridge every time he got out of bed late. Simeon knew the value of money, and that last vow did the trick. But even a holy man, a godly man, a serious Christian man, found that hard work required of him a certain discipline and the taking of steps. Second, the idler or sluggard is almost universally blind and intentionally blind to consequences, even when they are pointed out to him. Like many other character flaws, once allowed a place, they are very hard to eliminate. There will always be a reason not to do what one should, or not to do it with as much effort or dedication as it requires. "There is a lion in the street" refers to the world of excuses, very often pathetic excuses. Through the years, I have heard a great many of them and have learned the truth of this teaching of Proverbs. Idleness easily becomes a habit and then is very, very hard to break. We've watched this in this church among a few of our young people who have grown up to be idlers. And as much as we cajoled them, and as much as we urged them, and as much as we punished them, and as much as we exhorted them, we found it impossible to create in them a real love for hard work. Hard work is a virtue best instilled early in life, parents, because it is very difficult to turn a lazy person into a hard worker later on. This is a matter of great importance, even more so in our day, when institutionalized idleness is now so easily caught by young people. No culture has ever made idleness, useless activity, not directed to an important aim, end, or goal, so much a part of life for young people as Western culture has. A boy who spends hours playing video games is very likely to grow up a man who does not meet his responsibilities in life because those responsibilities can't be met in the time left after one has sated himself with play. Laziness always catches up with a person sooner or later. A student can pay little attention in class, skip the reading assignments, take perfunctory notes, and he or she will suffer nothing until it comes time to take the examination. But by then it's too late to learn all that should have been learned throughout the entire course of the semester. A real effective teacher, a really effective teacher, prevents this by whatever particular step or device he has chosen to use. I once had a class with the philosopher Gordon Clark in the interterm at Covenant Theological Seminary. And Dr. Clark's way of preventing this from happening in his classes was to intimidate, that's a weak word, terrorize his students. I remember on the first day of class, he handed out a reading list. And I thought that was interesting, something for my file. If I ever wanted to know what Gordon Clark thought were the most important things to read about religious epistemology, the philosophy of knowledge, I'd always have his list. He didn't say anything about what we were supposed to do with that list. But the next day in class, he began with his class cards, and he said, "Mr. Baker," or whatever the man's name who was first in the list, "did you read Augustine's De Magistro last night?" And Mr. Baker, of course, said, "No, sir, I didn't." "Did you read the first meditation of Descartes?" "No, sir, I didn't." Of course, everybody in the class and Dr. Clark knew this fellow hadn't read a thing last night. But he went right down the list. Work after work after work after work. "Did you read this one? Did you read this one? Did you read this one?" To which the student had, in increasing embarrassment, had to say, "No, I didn't read that either." And all the rest of us were sitting there praying, "Lord, if you'll just keep him from calling on me, I will serve you for the rest of my life." But I have never been as prepared for a class as I was for that one for the remainder of its course. I heard a story told about a young boy who was taking the violin, who was taken by his father to hear Itzhak Perlman in concert. And they bought the kind of ticket that allowed those who possessed it to go to the back of the arena or the back of the concert hall after the concert was over to meet the great musician. And this boy said to Mr. Perlman, "I would give anything to be able to play by the way you play." To which Perlman replied, "Would you really give anything?" And the boy said, "Yes." "Would you give 14 hours every day?" "Oh," said the boy, "most everything that is really worthwhile, everything that is truly a great reward in human life, comes to those who work hard for it. And if you're the kind of person who doesn't work hard, it is almost a certainty that you will live without the satisfaction of those wonderful rewards." And fourth, hard work provides both earthly rewards, success, prosperity in this world, and a spiritual satisfaction and fulfillment that cannot be compared to another hour in bed. Wisdom is reckoning with consequences, both good and bad. We've noticed that in the teaching of Proverbs already over and over again. The Bible is never embarrassed to make this connection between work and prosperity, between individual effort and individual success. I was struck reading recently that early on in the settlement of Plymouth, the Pilgrim settlers learned the very same lesson that the Soviet Union had to learn the hard way. Collectivism in labor and ownership does not and will not produce nearly as impressive results. Communal farming at Plymouth, which was the plan at first, had yielded meager results, and the people were starving. But when, out of necessity, individual settlers were given control over specific parcels of land and the right to the production of their own fields, harvests immediately increased in quality and quantity. Why? Because people worked harder when the work was tied directly to the results. If people would work as hard for a communal farm as for their own, Soviet agriculture might have prospered instead of failed. But hard work was key, and communism did not produce an ethic of personal industry. One of the abiding and undeniable facts of human life is the connection between industry and prosperity, between hard work and reward. Whoever works his land will have plenty of bread, but he who follows worthless pursuits lacks sense. Work, Luther famously observed, is holy, the hidden mask behind which the hidden God gives us what we need. And the holiness of work, and so of hard work, industry, is actually found everywhere in the Bible. The place of work as an instrument of trust in the Lord is everywhere in the Bible. The old adage, laborare est orare, to work is to pray, is an expression of that biblical theology of life. If the Lord has summoned you to work so as to enjoy the full measure of his blessing, if he has promised to reward your industry, then to work for the believer is to trust in the Lord, to count on his provision to be given in the way in which he has promised to give it. We know, of course, that this isn't the whole story. A hardworking Christian can be thrown into prison for his loyalty to Christ, or can suffer some ailment that makes it impossible for him to work. But in general, and Proverbs deals with what is ordinarily the case, the Lord blesses us and provides us, provides for us and grants us prosperity through industry, through hard work. You cannot find a lazy man or woman among the saints whose lives and examples are commended to us in Holy Scripture. Jesus was a very hard-working man, and he has left us an example that we should follow in his steps. The Apostle Paul was a very hard-working man. He was a man who wore himself out in the cause of the gospel. Those, of course, were men of genius and extraordinary public gifts. But even genius has never made hard work unnecessary. Geniuses, in fact, are typically very hard workers because they can see the great things their genius can produce. If only they will put their genius to work, they see this result and that result. But hard work is still required to exploit their great gifts. Indeed, the more you learn about the great writers, the great inventors, the great political leaders, the great military men, the more you appreciate the phenomenal amount of work they invested in their achievements. I read recently of, this is an aside, For Whom the Bell Tolls, Ernest Hemingway. He used to quote the Latin proverb, Ars est calere artem. It is an art to hide your art. And what he meant by that was, don't let him see how much work you put into this manuscript, how many times you go over it, how many words and phrases you change again and again and again and again until you have it just the right way. Let them think it just came off your pen that way, when in fact it didn't at all. It took a long time, an immense amount of effort to get each sentence right. I'm reading a new biography of the 19th century Scott Presbyterian, man of letters, editor of the very influential magazine, The British Weekly, William Robertson Nicoll. It was once said of him that he edited 5 papers with his right hand and contributed to as many more with his left, that he was not a man but an army of men directed by one cool, controlling brain. But in life, industry, hard work, is as valuable in the case of the plotter, which most of us are. Let's be honest. We may not have great gifts, but most of what is accomplished in the world is accomplished by people who set themselves to accomplish a piece of useful work and then keep at it until it is done. In fact, it's interesting and important that the Romans and the Greeks despised manual labor and consigned such work in largest part to slaves. It's one of the reasons they had slaves. They would not do the work of slaves themselves. But among the Jews, there was no such contempt for working with one's hands. Contempt for certain kinds of work is pagan, not Christian. Rabbi Judah in the second century is quoted as saying, "He who does not teach his own son a trade teaches him to be a thief." Jesus had a trade. Paul had a trade. Peter and John had trades, all of them different, by the way. Jesus was a carpenter, we read in Mark 6:3. Paul a tent maker, though the term employed in Acts 18:3 could refer to a leather worker. Peter and John were fishermen. It's certainly interesting, is it not, if not very important, that the principal figures of the New Testament history were tradesmen who had learned to work hard to make a living. A great many Christians since have drawn encouragement from the fact that Jesus and his apostles, by and large, belong to what we would nowadays call the working class, not the professional class. The entire grand panoply of achievement that we observe everywhere we look in our world, the extraordinary productivity of modern agriculture, the remarkable technological transformation of our world, the obliteration of boundaries in commerce and financial enterprise, you take this for granted. But those of us who are old enough to realize how rapidly and profoundly the world has changed, even in our own lifetime, realize what staggering achievements these are. Nowadays, we eat grapes 12 months out of the year. Unheard of just a generation ago. We produce more food from less land and in measures that would stagger the imagination of our forefathers, most of whom were farmers. You remember, I'm sure, those days not so long ago when if you, say, traveled to Europe, you had to calculate the amount of money you would require on your trip and then get that amount in traveler's checks before you left home. Nowadays, you need have no money whatsoever in your pocket because you can put your card, your debit card or credit card in an ATM anywhere in the world. Asia, Australia, Africa. We discovered Africa has ATM machines. There's one right across from African Bible University. Europe, Russia. Put your card in, you can get as much of the local currency as you may require. And if you want to call your children in some other part of the world, you have only to ring them up on your cell phone while you are whizzing down the interstate. These stupendous advances in human productivity are certainly not redemption. They do not portend peace with God, but they are dramatic demonstrations, demonstrations we take far too much for granted. We Christians should celebrate these things and draw everyone's attention to them. They are demonstrations of the extraordinary fruitfulness of the human mind and of the earth God has given us when these things are exploited by hardworking human beings. May I say as an aside that it is and has been under Christianity that the people of the world, all the people of the world, rich and poor alike, have prospered by far the most. Buddhism, with its eschatology of annihilation, has no future orientation to teach to its people that they might be driven to provide for the next generation. Hinduism's inflexible caste system cannot reward the hard worker with a greater measure of prosperity, and Islam seeks to impose the limitations of a 7th-century culture on a modern economy, thus frustrating the enterprise of the hardworking. But in Christian cultures, resting as they do on the doctrines that this world is God's gift to man and man's stewardship, and that man himself has been made in the image of the creative and working God, both creativity and enterprise have been fostered, have flowered, and have been richly rewarded. Do these advances, does this prosperity come with their own problems? To be sure, the corrupting power of human sin can spoil even the very best things in human life, and it does spoil them. But no one should minimize the extraordinary things that human beings achieve when they put their minds to something and work hard. And if that is true for human beings in general, how much more for the children of the Heavenly Father, whose work is offered in gratitude to God and whose work He has promised particularly to bless. We Christians can fear an emphasis on hard work because it may seem to undermine a proper Christian dependence upon the grace of God. If we make a point of teaching our children to work so as to achieve, will they continue to believe that at bottom they must receive their salvation and all of God's blessings as gifts freely given to them and not their own achievement? Can we insist on our children learning the connection between labor and prosperity while still giving all glory to God for a salvation they did not and could not earn? The answer to that question should be crystal clear in any Christian's mind. In the Bible, there is never a conflict between faith and work, between receiving and achieving. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me, said the Apostle Paul. God made us to work. He saves us to restore us to that life of meaningful and holy work. Work is not the curse, as has sometimes been mistakenly thought. Adam was a worker before sin entered the world. Pristine and sinless life was a hard-working life. The curse has made work toilsome, but work itself is not the curse any more than marriage or family or the Sabbath day. Other institutions of pre-fall human life are the curse. And so everywhere in the Bible and everywhere in Christian history, faith has made workers of men and women. That's as it ought to be. Could we imagine that faith would make us indolent and lazy and idle and useless to others? No one would ever dare say such a thing. Virtually any biblical commandment you can think of requires us to work. Try to love your neighbor as yourself without doing any work. Try to provide for your family, and he who doesn't do that is worse than an infidel, without working. Try to run the race, or fight the fight, or keep the faith without working. Work out your salvation. It's interesting. Same word is used for the bad kind of works and the very good kind of work that is part of the Christian life. God's grace is given to us to make us the right kind of workers and to bless our labors and to make them fruitful. So it's no surprise at all that contrary to the popular imagination of harp playing and cloud sitting, in the Bible, heaven is a place of fruitful and useful and satisfying work. We're going to be working forever and ever. God made us with a capacity for useful and fruitful work because as a worker himself, he loves the working life. And because as our Creator, he made us with a capacity to achieve through work. And because as our Savior, he has restored us to the life we ought to live, that life of wonderfully satisfying work offered to our God. God works all the time. He's never idle. And we are to be like him. Eden, before the fall, was a place of wonderfully fruitful work. Heaven will be such a place as well, and so our lives in between. And most of us, I think, have had the experience of how satisfying hard work can be. Hard workers are so much happier in this world than the lazy. And Christians who work hard rightfully find a tremendous satisfaction and fulfillment in their work, just as Proverbs teaches us they will. As the poet has it, blessed work. If thou dost bear God's curse, what must his blessing be? The world as God made it is a place where hard work brings blessing. It is simply to trust the Lord and to honor him that we live our lives according to that truth and teach our children to do the same. Amen.